outlet. A drug for shyness is christened Loquacia. As he's introduced in the novel, this nomenclature consultant has left his firm and he's taking on his toughest job yet, renaming the Middle American town of Winthrop, a town founded by slaves who called it Freedom. That is, until the Winthrop family moved in, set up a barbed wire factory, and renamed the town for themselves. In Whitehead's novel, a new money entrepreneur in Winthrop wants to attract new workers to town and lobbies to have the name changed to New Prospera. And the story begins. In many ways, suggests Whitehead, it is the story of us all. This hour on Point, the celebrated novelist Colson Whitehead on identity, race, language, and branding in America. You can join the conversation. Are you a Colson Whitehead fan from The Intuitionist or John Henry days or The Colossus of New York? And what is in a name? Have you ever thought of renaming yourself, your town, your country? Joining me now from Toronto is Colson Whitehead. His new novel is Apex Hides the Hurt. He was a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient in 2002 and has been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His writing, says John Updike, refreshes our sense of the world. Colson Whitehead, wonderful to have you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
So here we are. We've been having fun looking through the clips about you and all the names and associations ladled out on this young novelist. You know, you're compared with Ralph Ellison and Toni Morrison and Thomas Pynchon and Saul Bellow. And you came out in 1999 with The Intuitionist, and the GQ magazine called it one of the best books of the millennium. That got in just under the wire. How's it feel? How's it feel to be out there in this world where you get branded too?
Well, I mean, you know, I spend most of my life in my house, in my office. I work from home. So for about a week and a half every year, I emerge and talk about books and what I do. So it's always odd to sort of hit the light of day and see what's going on out there.
A lot of naming, a lot of branding. That's at the heart of the book. What got you on to branding and identity and language through this kind of high artifice lens in the first place?
Well, about 8 years ago, I read an article in the New York Times Magazine about the naming of Prozac. And it was about these sort of maverick marketing guys who try and find the right prefix and suffix arrangement of syllables that they can get together to make the product fly off the shelves. So I thought, oh, there's a strange occupation, and perhaps one day I'll do something about it. And a couple years later, because I write about cities a lot, I was thinking about residential zones and business zones and who sort of determines what's what. And I was thinking about street names. If you walk down downtown Brooklyn, there's Skirmerhorn Street and Hoyt Street. Mm. And to me, they're just, you know, intersections. But at one point, these guys were men of industry, important men who were honored by having a street named after them. So I was thinking about sort of cycles of power. And one day I put the two ideas together and having a corporate namer come and name a town.
It's a wonderful story, wonderful in the way that it opens our eyes to the way that we're surrounded. I mean, in one way, we know it. We're marketed all the time. The spam box and everybody's email is full of the most bizarre pharmaceutical names, as you say. And Americans, maybe from the beginning of the American story, have been very interested in names. There's a passage, it's actually later on in the book, but I love the way it kind of illuminates part of what you're up to here, Colson Whitehead, about the names of American communities. I wonder if you could, if you've got a copy, if you could crack it open around 207 and read from us, sort of share the aspirational quality of many American town names.
Sure, sure. The protagonist is trying to figure out what exactly he's doing, and he thinks about a certain kind of city name. Any handy road atlas describes the long tradition of noun names, adjectival names, that yoke abstraction to dirt, where we can get our grimy hands on it. Confluence, Kentucky, Friendship, Louisiana, Superior, Colorado, Commerce, Oklahoma, Plush, Oregon, Hope, Arkansas, naturally. Oftentimes, these names can be found on the sides of packages of laundry detergent or abrasive cleaners, so generous and thorough is the sweep of their connotation. Freedom, needless to add. Can't forget freedom. Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. Hard to knock such brave and laudable candor, such ballsy defiance to the notion of salesmanship. Pity the poor Board of Tourism for Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. Death Valley, too. One points for its plain-spoken delivery, seeming to say, It's not like we didn't warn you. There were towns whose names were like thieves attempting to pick the pocket of history, but instead became punchlines to jokes about the perils of juxtaposition. Milan, Minnesota, Lebanon, Oklahoma, Dublin, Iowa, Brooklyn, Ohio. As if history came equipped with tiny snap-on hooks, was lightweight and portable, and could be thrown up on available surfaces to accent the scheme of any room. There was also a long tradition of naming places for great men, or at least men who believed in their greatness. He'd always had a soft spot for Amerigo Vespucci, who got lost while looking for the Indies and hit nomenclature's big kahuna instead. Unless there was a gent named Europa he'd never heard about. He couldn't argue with America. It was one of those balloon names. It kept stretching as it filled up, getting bigger and bigger and thinner and thinner. What kind of gas it was, stretching the thing to its limits, who could say? Whatever we dreamed. And of course, one day it would pop. But for now, it served its purpose. For now, it was holding together.
Novelist Colson Whitehead, reading from his new book, Apex Hides the Hurt. Apex, his anti-hero's most famous naming success for a Band-Aid that comes in multi kind of skin colors. You can wear whatever matches your own, I guess, and he wears one himself. We want to talk about your story, Mr. Whitehead, but I wish you'd take us a little deeper into this story first and the tensions around running through the naming of this little town, Winthrop. Not the Winthrop that's 8 or 10 miles from where I'm sitting now, but a Winthrop somewhere in the middle of America. There's a racial undertone and quite a big one in this story as well.
Yeah, I guess I always start with a very abstract idea. What if a corporate namer had to name a town? With John Henry days, how do we update this industrial age myth for the information age? And then as I try to figure out characters in the story, all sorts of themes end up creeping in. So I guess when I was thinking about what sort of town he'd have to name, I had to invent a history. So when he gets this assignment, he's thinking he can just do his standard branding job. He's had an accident and hasn't worked in a while. And when he gets this call to rename the town, he thinks, okay, I can just do it the old way. But of course he does research and he meets the people, and it ends up being a lot more complicated. It was founded by freed slaves, and they trekked across the prairie and dropped their bags and decided to name this plot of land Freedom, which is, it's very honest and a bit corny to our protagonist. I mean, how can you just name something so hopeful, so baldly? There's no sort of finesse to it. And then, of course, when Winthrop brings his barbed wire factory, he sort of makes a power move and renames it after himself, which to me seems perfectly fine. If I, you know, had a town, I'd call it Colson 10 or, you know, Colsonville. Mm-hmm. And then in the present of the book, a hometown boy named Good, named Lucky Aberdeen,
right,
thinks it should be renamed something peppy and zippy, something that reflects 20th century sort of new economy, new capitalism. And he's brought his computer company back to the town, and he wants to attract more business. So New Prospera is his gig. And, the protagonist is forced to consider his old way of naming, this kind of superficial thing, versus trying to get at the essence of something, and that's sort of his struggle in the book.
There's a race element. It starts with the Band-Aids, or I guess you have to say Apex. What? Mm-hmm. Adhesives. That take the color of their wearer or can. But there's an element here that's absolutely universal these days, when we're all hearing about Operation Enduring Freedom or whatever the sort of fancy name of the latest commercial marketing campaign or government marketing campaign is. Do you see us as all living in hurricane of shaping language in this very deliberate way these days?
Well, a lot about naming is... it's about ownership. And when I started the book 6 years ago and I chose Freedom as the name for the original town, I had no idea about the sort of abuse that would go on in terms of certain words like Freedom with our current administration.
It's gotten a big workout.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't really see what was going to happen. And so, but I think it demonstrates what I'm talking about in the book, is that each sort of person who comes to power has their own sort of way of using words and renaming things. And when you do that, you erase what's come before and you put your own stamp on it. And whoever, you know, is in power at that moment, whether it's Winthrop or the computer guys, sort of takes their shot.
And in a way, as you describe it, the corporate realm that is always in its own realm of power is always doing this. I mean, right, left, and center, Americans live in that naming stew always coming at them.
Yeah, I mean, when I was coming up with names for products, some of which you named earlier, they came very naturally. And I think that's because we're sort of living in this amino acid this sort of broth of marketing. And so a lot of these, you know, a lot of these kind of zippy marketing names are sort of in our consciousness and just ready to be tapped. I think when we hear a certain brand name, for me it's Ambien or Allegra. I think they sound really sweet and inviting. That's because we've been trained for so many years to respond to certain syllables, a certain arrangement of prefixes and suffixes. And so a lot of times when I was coming up with products, it seemed to come a little bit too easily.
Maybe for us all. It's a terrific exercise. There's a lot more we want to learn. Colson Whitehead's new novel is Apex Hides the Hurt. Listeners, you can join us. Are you a Colson Whitehead fan from the Intuitionist or John Henry days or the Colossus of New York? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Loomis Sayles, researching and investing for pension funds, foundations, and individuals with a sustained commitment to giving back to the community. More at Loomis, SAYLES.com. And the law firm of Rob
Branding and the web of language we're all caught in. Has Madison Avenue turned everything into a sales job, a spin? Or is it the White House with Operation Enduring Freedom and Desert Storm? Or have we done it to ourselves, in our names, our illusions? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. A couple of names that you now live with, Colson Whitehead. One is Genius from the MacArthur Foundation. Grant $500,000. Very nice, thank you, in 2002. How does that one sit on your shoulders in the week and a half a year that you get out of the house to talk to the rest of the world, Genius?
Well, you know, obviously, it's a really sort of great thing. And as I look back over the last couple of years and what it's given me, I've just, you know, the validation is great. One of the first things I got was a sort of new chair and desk. When I wrote my first couple of books, I had a really crappy chair and a crappy desk, and I have bad posture, and I can't really type. So after a long day of work, I just needed to pop Advil, and so just from being hunched over. So I got an ergonomic chair, and you know things have been a bit better in my life. But I think the validation just sort of made me a lot more mellow about things, and I've been trying different things in my work, and the stuff I'm working on now I'm really proud of. And I think that's because there's a certain desperation I sort of abandoned, and it's been very sort of good for me.
A laying on of hands there, and the money doesn't hurt either. I'm sure you write interestingly, and of course others reading you write, about how African Americans have, from history and culture, a special relationship with names. So many renamed in the passage from Africa to the Americas into slavery. There's a reading I wonder if you might do for us on page 191 that gives a little bit of the sense of that, if you'd be good enough to set it up and share it with us.
Okay, the protagonist has been reading a history of the town written by a woman named Gertrude Sanders, a librarian. And it was written in the 30s, so she uses the word colored a lot. So he's been thinking about that. And here we go. Colored. The sliver of himself, still in tune with marketing, shivered each time Gertrude used the word colored. He kept stubbing his toe on it, as it were. Colored, Negro, Afro-American, African-American. She was a few iterations behind the times. Not that you could keep up anyway. Every couple of years, someone came up with something that got us an inch closer to the truth. Bit by bit, we crept along, as if that thing we believed to be approaching actually existed. It was her use of the word that got him thinking about it. You call something by a name, you fix it in place. A thing or a person, it didn't matter. The name you gave it allowed you to draw a bead, take aim, shoot. But there was a flip side of calling something by the name you gave it, and that was wanting to be called by the name you gave to yourself. What is the name that will give me the dignity and respect that is my right, the key that will unlock the world? Before it colored, slave. Before slave, free. And always somewhere, nigger. What was next, in the great procession? Because things never remain still for long. What will we call ourselves next, he wondered. If he knew what was next, he'd know who he would be.
Who he would be. Colson Whitehead reading from his novel Apex Hides the Hurt. We're at 1-800-423-8255. You know, you got me so attuned to names in the process of reading this, I began to think about yours. First you've got the Colson piece, and of course a lot of African Americans from literature and from life, Coleman Hawkins, Bessie Coleman, E.L. Doctorow's Colehouse Walker, that kind of Cole syllable sitting right there, at least in cultural memory. And that up against Whitehead, how do you deconstruct your own name, Colson Whitehead?
there's a lot going on. According to my dad, Whitehead is a Native American name, going back a few generations, from Seminole Reservation in Florida. My full name is a bit of a mouthful. My full name is Arch Colson Chip Whitehead. Up until college, I was known as Chip by my family and friends. And when I got out of college, I thought, well, Chip is a nice sort of white preppy name. I don't really identify with it. I'm a man now. I'm 21. Mm-hmm. I graduated from college. And I went with Colson. Arch was my dad's first name. He was born Archibald. Didn't like it, so he got it legally changed to Arch, which I've always found strange because if you're just going to change your name, you might as well pick something
go all
like,
the way,
you know,
right.
Like, you know, Biff or, you know, Chuck or something. And, you know, I had some issues at the time, so I didn't want to take my father's name, so slay the father, go with Colson. And now, of course, I mean, I dig Colson, but I think Archie is kind of fun. So maybe when I, you know, a couple of years ago, I'll go with Archie. I'm not sure.
I say stick with Colson Whitehead. It's got great resonance to it. But there is that, I mean, lots of people change names. But African-Americans, many have walked away from names that were seen as slave names, names of owners at one time, gone in all kinds of directions. I remember a few years ago, I was in a Kinko's coffee shop across from the Merchandise Mart in Chicago, and the young woman, very nice young woman helping me out there who worked at the store, had her name tag on, her name was Velveeta. I thought, wow, we would take names from everywhere.
Well, I mean, it's about ownership. I mean, self-ownership. I mean, I think what I was talking about in that passage is, you know, the process by that each generation sort of takes a name and chooses it. And it's saying, you know, the previous name, maybe colored worked for you, but Afro-American works for us. You know, I have a daughter who's a year and a half, and I'm sure that, you know, when she's 25, she and her kooky generation will have some new name that she wants to be, you know, called. And it'll work for her. It won't be something that we imposed on her. It'll be her and her sort of generation deciding, saying, this is who we are. And then, you know, the next generation will come and combine, erase it. But I think it's, you know, a very sort of important thing to say, I'm this, and you can't sort of put a certain set of assumptions or labels on me.
And we do it every day. We're talking with novelist Colson Whitehead. His new novel is Apex Hides the Hurt. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Have you ever thought of renaming yourself, your town, your country? Eric's calling from Boston. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a freelance writer, and recently I was working on an article about the reconstruction effort in Iraq, and okay, so I'm using all these corporate names, Halliburton, Bechtel, and whatnot, and I use Microsoft Word. And I discovered that these corporate names and then others like Coca-Cola and Starbucks are pre-programmed into the grammar dictionary of Microsoft Word.
Okay, and what does that mean? How does that work?
Well, I got curious about it, and I found that, okay, so they make the grammar dictionary with 99,000 English words and phrases, and there's nearly a million words in the English language. So I try to, I'm wanting a Mr. Whitehead's view of that and how that affects the English lexicon in our own, you know, daily lives.
You mean the fact of brand names becoming formally part of the family of the language?
Right, and especially with something like a program like Microsoft Word, which an enormous number of people use on a regular basis, I think.
Colson Whitehead?
Well, I mean, I think obviously our corporate overlords got together at the annual meeting and, you know, decided which of their company names would get into the Microsoft Word word list. I think every couple of months they probably do this and make sure that when companies merge, the new spelling is in Microsoft Word. In terms of, names like Band-Aid, Vaseline, Q-tip, I've always admired that process whereby the thing becomes one with the name. So we don't say, let's get the copier out. We say, we Xerox it. I think when there's that sort of perfect marriage between word and object, I think it's a beautiful thing. I make fun of marketing a lot in the book, but I think obviously at this point, after writing about publicity in John Henry days and writing this book, there's something I really admire about advertising in the marketing world and how they can get these sort of insidious phrases into our brains so that they're etched on our consciousness. I think the process just gets more and more sort of clever and insidious. I can't help but sort of salute when someone comes up with this sort of perfect arrangement of syllables.
And you're a man of words. What does that leave us with? David Gates, the New York Times, read Apex Hides the Hurt, and his mind went to Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, and the line, words are grown so false, I'm loath to prove reason with them. Are you taking it that far? Are you saying, do we have a corrupted language? Is it made stronger, weaker, illusory by this kind of very deliberate manipulation?
It is corrupt, but it's ours. And we're sort of stuck with it. There's a part in the book where a character criticizes the computer magnate, and another character says, well, you can't blame him for being sort of evil. That's like blaming water for being wet. It's ours. We're stuck with it. And we're going to have to find a way to live in this sort of corrupted space because we have no choice.
Eric, thanks very much for your call. It's just coming right in every direction there. When it's right in the computer program, it's got us from every direction. Let's take a call from Florence, South Carolina. William's on the line. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
We're well. What do you think, William? What do you know?
I was pretty much listening to the talk, so I was just scanning the radio and caught you guys, and I was pretty much impressed by Colson and his accomplishments to be a 21-year-old writer, African-American writer.
I'm impressed, too, though he's not 21 anymore, 30, 36 or so now, but he's still darned impressive. I agree.
Oh, yeah, he is. And my questions for him is, what inspired him to become a writer? And, like, during his weak moments in writing, what, like, gave him the endurance to keep on to actually come out with a finished work?
Are you a writer yourself, William?
I am. I'm 25 years old, and I am just impressed. Writing. I mean, it's just, it's a love of mine.
Colson Whitehead, speak to your admirer here who's looking for some guidance and inspiration.
Well, in terms of how I started writing, I was a bookish kid and didn't like to leave the house. So my favorite activity was reading comic books, watching science fiction on television. By the time I was in junior high, I thought I wanted to write Spider-Man or write Stephen King, sort of scary novels. Then, of course, when I got to high school and college, I started reading more so-called highbrow literature, being inspired by people like Toni Morrison and Thomas Pynchon. And I thought, okay, well, there's a way I can talk about contemporary society in a way that's sort of vital to me and interesting. But I wasn't doing that much about it. My sort of apprenticeship as a writer came when I started working at the Village Voice when I got out of school. And I was writing book reviews and music reviews, and I became a TV columnist. And having that sort of public forum where if you write a great article, people say, "Hey, Cole, you know, congratulations." And if you write a dud, there's complete silence, right. So you know you sort of messed up. I worked through a lot of bad habits and eventually became confident enough to start writing fiction, and the freelancer schedule helped with that. It's always hard. My first novel I wrote, got an agent. Everyone, 20-something publishers, passed on it. My agent dumped me. And I was, I just sort of watched a lot of Jerry Springer for about 6 months. But then I realized I was not going to become a lawyer or a vet or something or change my career. I was a writer. And I just had to keep working at it. And so I think you write some incredibly poorly written things, and you make mistakes, and hopefully you learn from them. And you keep moving on. It's hard to find support. It's hard to find people who are going to give you feedback. But you have to keep going. And I've had a lot of good things happen to me so far in my career, and I've been very fortunate. But a good review is not going to it's not going to put words on the page the next day. And so after all is said and done, it's just you and your computer when you sit down, or your pad or whatever. And it's always difficult, no matter what sort of where the things are going well or going poorly. So I think just have to believe in your project and keep going despite whatever setbacks come your way.
You seem incredibly open to serendipity in this process. Maybe I misread it, but I mean, The Intuitionist, your first book, this kind of fantasy allegory, but with some very serious conceptual work behind it, but about Lila Mae Watson and her adventures as, in your words, the first colored woman to become a New York City elevator inspector. She inspects not mechanically, but using her intuition. I mean, the very idea is just seems like wonderful serendipity. How do you decide what to hitch yourself to when it's substantial enough?
Well, I mean, I always have two or three things I want to work on when I finish a project. And I'm not sure what I'm going to work on until I see which one I end up thinking about the most, and that's what I end up working on. In terms of how these ideas develop, really, it really is just sort of accidental and very strange. I start off with a weird proposition, as I call it. And then as I try to think of characters and situations that can accommodate these ideas, different things present themselves. With The Intuitionist, I wrote a book that no one liked, and so I figured, well, I'm able to just try to figure out how to do a plot. People seem to like that sort of thing. So I borrowed the detective novel structure of criminal overlords, corrupt politicians, hitmen, and decided to have, what the heck, I'll have an elevator inspector solve a criminal case. So I tried and become a detective, and so I did some research and tried to figure out what kind of skills an elevator inspector would bring to a criminal case, and unfortunately the answer was none, because they inspect elevators, and so the mystery became about elevators and not a criminal case. And I figured if they have these skills, they go to a school, and if there's a school, there's probably academic infighting, and that became the genesis of the idea of the empiricists who inspect elevators the right way, and the intuitionists who use sort of, their divine powers.
And there you've backed into an issue that's kind of front and center in our culture today, willy-nilly or by design?
For me, it's just very organic. Mm-hmm. If you have this sort of binary relationship, then it can be liberals and conservatives, it can be rationality and spirituality. And over the book, those two placeholders evolve.
William in South Carolina, thanks so much for your call. I hope that's inspiration for you. We're talking this hour with novelist Colson Whitehead. His new novel is Apex Hides the Hurt. You can join us. What do you hear in the voice of this celebrated young African-American novelist? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Colson, we'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Mm-hmm. Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles.
Imagine that an old-time tune is like a vintage automobile, and a modern-day string band is behind the wheel.
The driver's seat is available to hop into, and once you get in and you get it running, I mean, you can go as fast as you want to go if you know how to drive.
Take a test drive with old...
8255 is our number, 1-800-423-TALK. Maura Lee's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Maura Lee, you're on the air.
Thanks.
Sure.
I have a question. I'm Native American and white and have a name that is from, it's a generational family name. And when Colson mentioned that he had an 18-month-old daughter, I thought, what name did he choose to give her? And does it have anything to do with really where he's from and what he hopes to perpetuate or empower in her? And with naming being so important, how did he choose to do that?
Ooh, wonderful. And we're all curious. Colson.
Well, her name is Madeline Juniper Stovall Whitehead. Stovall is her mom's last name. Madeline, we had a big fight over the first name. There's nothing too deep about it. I prefer short, sort of Nina, two-syllable type names. And she liked longer names, so Maddie, Madeline works for us. Juniper, we actually stole before she was born. We were in a birthing class with some other couples, and we didn't, you know, end up becoming friends with them. But once the babies were born, people send out photographs of their kid.
Sure.
And someone had named their daughter Juniper, and since we hadn't seen these folks for a while, we're like, oh, Juniper's a nice name. Let's steal that for the middle name. Unfortunately, all the moms sort of became friends. All the moms in the birthing class became friends. So there was after a couple of weeks.
Right.
So there's this awful time when we didn't know how to say that, oh, we stole Juniper from you. It's a middle name. So after a few tense months, we finally, you know, came out and told her, and it's fine. It's sort of water under the bridge.
So do you think about it? I mean, more or least clearly thinking about it. Do you think about the resonance of this for your daughter, what she's going to carry, what you've told her by what you've named her?
She has such a weird personality. I still have no idea how she takes what we say. She's still, you know, babbling and has her own language, so we'll see what happens.
But one day she'll be thinking about it. Morally, you described yourself interestingly as Native American and white. How does naming come in? How has it come into your family, your life? Have you been caught up on different sort of cultural impulses?
Well, sure. I mean, no one in my family's ever lived on a reservation, but we're three-quarters Native American, so I'm Indian by genetics, but not necessarily by culture. But I want to own that, and I sort of have to. I'm living in the South. I've been down here for 10 years. People ask me often what I am, which is an odd question. I went to school back East, and I was never asked that. But moving down here, they ask me, what are you? Mm-hmm. So I am Native American, but when I've talked to other Native Americans, they call me Apple, and I might be red on the outside, but I'm white inside. What they've said, which is true. I certainly don't want to try to pretend anything. But
what about you? You put Colson on the hot seat. If you do or would have kids, would you be tempted to put something? You know, I don't know, Flying Cloud or you name it. There.
No. What I did. My name actually is a fifth generation hybrid of Native American and white. It means dark, bitter one. In a grassy green meadow, and the first dark child in each generation of our half-breed family gets this sort of legacy of bitterness, if you will, to remember our ancestors.
So, Maura Lee means all that?
Maura, mm-hmm.
I see.
Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
So I have a daughter, and the first dark child I had, I gave her an M-A-U-R name to continue that. So I don't know. I don't know if it's good. I don't know if she won't like it when she grows up. I just sort of felt that I couldn't be the chain that sort of stopped that legacy.
Oh, so we hear it. It's a wonderful vein of contemplation. I guess every parent certainly wrestles with it at some level when they name their children. And Morley, thanks very much for your call. Michael's calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah. I wanted to make a comment before I asked a question. I haven't heard it yet, but I wanted to tell Colson that there are the humor in both John Henry Days and Apex Hides the Herd, yeah, I think is something that might be overlooked. But there is some remarkable, funny scenes in those books.
There really are.
And overtone. And I just want to note, when I was reading John Henry Days about 4 years ago, and I read the passage to my daughter, who was then 12, about Jay, the protagonist, finally getting to the prime rib at the dinner at this conference he was attending, she couldn't stop laughing.
This is the journalist who makes a goal of hitting every sort of free spread in New York City.
Yes, and he starved himself. He won't spend any money, and so he's waiting to get to the dinner. It is very funny.
Yeah.
I also want to say that I've read all his fictional books, and I haven't really read anything like them. I think The Intuitionist, Colson is being modest, but I mean, in describing that that plot, there is just elements of that I just have never really read in any other contemporary work.
Yeah, sublime.
And I did want to ask a question, though, because Apex Hides the Herd is different in scope than the last two books, especially John Henry Days, which really seemed to develop into a there was an awful lot to that book, and Apex Hides the Herd is a shorter book. And I wonder if that was just a natural, if that evolved out of the natural process as he was writing the book, or what determines the scope of the theme in the book that he is writing.
Colson, it's a lot shorter, just for starters, but what about the difference in scope?
Sure. I also want to thank you for your kind words and addressing, I guess, humor in the work. Because I have a very sort of sardonic take on the world, and when I try to talk about serious things, it always ends up being in sort of I don't know. I have a certain point of view, and I try to mix a very sort of serious tone with a comic tone, and try to find a nice mix. That wasn't very articulate. I apologize. But
you do it. Read the book. It's all there.
In terms of the size of Apex and how it relates to my previous work, I feel like each book is an antidote to the one that's come before. So The Intuitionist was very controlled. Lila Mae Watson is a very sort of repressed character. And so I wanted to have a lot of different voices with John Henry Days. And free reign to have it take place in a lot of different time periods and locales, and really sort of have a different sort of narrative voice and tone. And so when I started Apex, and I started a long time ago in actually 2000, just a few months after I finished John Henry Days, I knew I wanted to do something that was a little more compact, which followed one character and had a narrative voice that was a little more controlled and very close to the protagonist. And also, I wanted to push the humor a bit more. In The Intuitionist, there's a lot of deadpan humor, but it was very submerged because of the character of Lila Mae and the situation. I felt if I had, if I was trying to make a world where elevator inspectors were very important, the humor had to be sort of strategically placed. And there's a broader comic sensibility in John Henry Days. And with Apex, I just wanted to sort of push it a bit more. So I think from the very outset, as an antidote to John Henry Days, I wanted to have make it a short, compact comic novel. And so the protagonist is sort of wrestling with these sort of bigger themes about naming and what it means. But I wanted to have a lighter tone and a more controlled sense of these different themes.
Michael, did you still get a satisfying meal in this more compact novel?
Yes, I did. I'm not surprised to hear him say that he wanted to do something more compact, because John Henry Days is so ambitious and successful. And this is, too, in its own way. I thought it was very funny, very rewarding, and I'm always looking for his new book.
There's a thumbs up. We love it. Michael, thank you very much for your call. You know, Colson Whitehead, it might be good to share some of that humor. There's a passage where you're an always unnamed, interestingly, hero, protagonist, anti-hero, call him what you will, is at an awards ceremony, and looking at the people as he actually sees them around him. I mean, names can disguise, but he's daydreaming about how they might also reveal. It's funny in a kind of bitter way. I wonder if you could read on page 170 for us a bit of that.
Sure. In the, I guess, the present tense of the book, he's come to the town to name it. But in his previous life, 6 months before, he's had an accident, and this is the sort of night where he's having a bit of a breakdown. And it's at the annual award ceremony with the corporate namers. They're sitting around patting each other on the back, and he's having a severe physical reaction. Panting at this point, he wiped the sweat from his eyes. A jagged thing readjusted itself in his gut. The others in the room applauded as if their lives depended on it. He imagined that all of them had their true names written on their name tags. That would be something. That would be honest, he whispered to himself. Liar, bedwetter. Those two sitting at Mandala's table, the British firm making so much noise recently. If everyone could see everyone else's true name, we could cut out all this subterfuge and camouflage, the deception that was their stock in trade and the whole world's favorite warm teat. Romantic, failure, empty. He coughed and shuddered and pulled his lapels tight. It wouldn't have to stop with this room. What if everyone everywhere wore their true names for everyone to see? Of course, it begins at birth. By giving their children names, parents did their offspring the favor of teaching them how to lie with their very first breath. Because what we go by is rarely what makes us go. Grifter, sinner, doomed. Mandala won for best slogan for, "We put the meta in your morphosis," which had really helped that new health club chain get a leg up. The losing nominees marshaled their fake smiles and waited until no one's eyes were upon them. A pale young man walked up to the podium and made a joke. Everybody laughed. Witty repartee and anecdote jokes for everyone. He noticed that Bart Grafton was trying to look down Bridget's shirt. She giggled at something Bart said. He didn't care. It allowed him space for his thoughts. Criminal. Whore. The man at the podium was named Victim, and surely after he received his award, his life would resume its natural course of misadventure. Bart Grafton leaned over and advised, "Hang on to this one. She's good first wife material." Pederast announced the nominees for Best Name Medical. All the really cool stuff these days was in pharmaceuticals. That's what they kept saying around the office, especially the younger guys, when given a girdle or denture account and cursing their lot. He never cared what kind of account he got. It was all the same. He looked down at himself and saw that he'd sweated through his shirt. Wring it out and watch his fluid self fall to the floor. Bridget saw him loosen his tie and said, "It's all in your head, baby." He heard them call his name as he slipped out of the room. Fugitive.
Colson Whitehead, reading from his new novel, Apex Hides the Herd, and putting the labels right on the people at that particular conference: failure, empty, grifter, sinner, doomed, and himself, fugitive. Ray's calling from Philadelphia. Hi, Ray, you're on the air.
Hi. Mr. Whitehead, I wanted to ask you about the name Chip. You talked about it earlier in the show, and indeed it is the second name on the list of the most preppy in the preppy handbook. And you changed your name at a point of transition from college to beyond. I'm wondering about your family and how they reacted to that change and whether they adopted it.
Well, I think people who knew me from childhood and my family still called me Chip. And, you know, people who I've sort of met since then, obviously, and people, friends of mine from college, who I still see, have made the change to Colson. Kudos to them. I have a weird thing about the name Chip. There was a bar on Amsterdam and in the 60s in New York City, and it was spelled with two P's, as my name was, C-H-I-P-P. And I had some sort of moment of cognitive horror a couple years ago when I was like, what if I was conceived after some night at Chip's bar? And that's why they named me Chip. And, you know, it's an homage to, you know, some watering hole on the West Side, which is now gone. So you know, people, my family still calls me Chip, and that's fine. And Colson's fine, too. And if people start calling me, the good thing about having Arch as my first name is that when people call me, I always know it's a creditor or something. And I can say, you know, Arch isn't in right now. Because the only people who call me Arch are, it's for official business.
Left that behind. Ray, are you hearing that?
Yeah. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your call, Ray. What about these other names, Colson Whitehead? Here you are still relatively young, and you've got these names, Pynchon, Bellow, Ellison, Morrison, floating around you. I mean, people even go outside literature, Malcolm Gladwell and David Brooks. You've got a lot of names of expectation and accolade floating around you right now. How do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, that's really external. I mean, I certainly enjoy a lot of those writers, and it's nice to be mentioned in the same breath as Morrison and Ellison and Pynchon. And I think I've learned stuff from them, and, I guess when you sort of say he writes in this mode, he writes like this, you're trying to place it in context for readers who aren't familiar with the work, and that's just sort of part of the business of book reviewing and literary discussion. So, but it is really external, and has nothing to do with what I do in a day-to-day thing. I'll just take it as a compliment and take it as not a sign of being too derivative of these folks, and keep doing what I do.
You're still carrying a special spot for comic books. Do you see one in your future? Oh, he who was inspired by X-Men.
I don't read them that often, but in the months before I was before my daughter was born, and I was trying to finish Apex and procrastinating, I found myself reading some of my old comics. I had them all, all the thousands still in plastic bags, and I started listening to early '80s music. So I was having some kind of weird regression thing where I was listening to Echo and the Bunny Man and reading X-Men as I was having some reaction to becoming a father. So perhaps if we have another kid, I'll go even deeper and start reading Dr. Seuss or something, or listening to Sesame Street albums. I'm not sure.
Well, we will be reading you, and we're very grateful to you for being with us today from Toronto. Colson Whitehead, wonderful speaking with you. Congratulations on the book. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot. It was really fun.
Colson Whitehead, his new novel is Apex Hides the Hurt, his earlier works The Colossus of New York, John Henry Days, and The Intuitionist. You can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio. Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities.